Hello and welcome to the program. This is another episode of Beyond the Mekong for the Diplomat. I am Luke Hunt and with me today is Hugh Watkin. Hugh, welcome to the program.
G'day Luke, how are you?
Yeah, good. It's been an interesting month. You've been travelling around the region as I have. The past 6 weeks we've had the earthquake in Myanmar, the commemorations, celebrations for the 50th anniversary of the fall of Indochina to the communists. And we're back in Bangkok from where we've just seen, as Australian journalists, we've just witnessed the Australian elections, which it was an interesting result. I'd like to say thoroughly predictable. But let's start with Indochina, your take on Vietnam. You worked there a long time, you're married into the country.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a hell of a show.
It was, and really stark, the difference between now and when I was actually correspondent there 25 years ago, where the legacy of the war and pretty hard-nosed Marxist-Leninism was still a big deal.
Yeah.
Of course, I was restricted to Ho Chi Minh City during this trip, but the level of prosperity that you see in Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City, is really something to behold. And there's that was fairly consistent across the region. So you're seeing in these countries a level of prosperity and efficiency. Not that they're without their issues and problems, but it makes you take a second look at the West and how far we're actually falling behind in terms of our infrastructure, the ability to get things done. The commemoration itself, I think, was extremely well done. And as you saw, hugely supported by the population.
Right.
I mean, the closest thing I've seen to it is a Vietnamese soccer win over Thailand, which is always a big event. But that just paled into irrelevance.
There's a report out the other day just saying that the Vietnamese economy is poised to become number two in ASEAN after Indonesia and surpassing Thailand, which is a hell of a leap. Over the last 25 years. But what surprised me most with these commemorations is that I think typically every 5 years when they do this, they've been quite low-key. And there's always been this issue that they don't want to rub salt into the wounds of the Americans or the West about what happened. They've never been cheap or churlish in the sense of, ha-ha, we won. They're never like that at all.
And it helps to have one, of course.
Of course, it's, this is true. One of the issues that had always stuck with Hanoi was their treatment of the old Viet Cong, the former Viet Cong soldiers. And this time around, they seemed to be reaching out. I mean, there were as many blue and red, yellow-starred Viet Cong flags fluttering alongside the national flag of the Vietnamese, which I hadn't seen before, and it seemed to be this an enormous reach out from Hanoi, basically saying we're sorry about the past, we're sorry if we're rude, and we're trying to get in this new younger generation of Vietnamese kids into this concept of what is Vietnam,
national unity.
That's
a great point, because there was still, let's say, a haughty arrogance from Hanoi towards the south when I was a correspondent here in the late 90s, early
last century,
early 20s, yes, back in the steam age. I think that the party has come to realize that Ho Chi Minh City is the engine of economic growth. It was interesting what you're saying about its economic progress. I've read, I can't remember exactly where, but recently, the proposition that in 50 years it'll be Southeast Asia's Japan in terms of its economic impact, but also its diplomatic impact. The Vietnamese are extremely good diplomats. They punch way above their weight globally, or regionally and globally, and they're just really smart people.
It's a difficult, awkward question in some points because we were both in Cambodia for the 50th anniversary, which of course was a completely different result for the Cambodians, where the Vietnamese get to advertise unification, liberation. The Cambodians got Pol Pot, genocide, massive crimes against humanity. And they haven't fared as well. And I was asked the other night, actually, it was on ABC Radio, what is it about the Vietnamese? And of course, it's a very difficult question to ask. Well, but the Vietnamese have this work ethic.
Hmm. Well, there's a very strong sense of Vietnamese nationalism.
Right.
And they're almost sorry for you for not being Vietnamese. If you know what I mean. Yeah. But again, too, I think, you know, they didn't... Well, the war, of course, was an absolute terrible catastrophe which stretched over, you know, decades. But, of course, Vietnamese history as a power, as a civilization, goes back thousands of years. And I think, by comparison, Cambodia's political culture remains very immature still.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost feudal. It's a kleptocracy, let's be honest about it. The wealthy are very uncaring about the people of Cambodia. Although I would add, Phnom Penh, the signs of prosperity were there. But we all know, I mean, this is, frankly, it's a mafia state.
Right, and the changes of government help. And by that, yes, Vietnam is a one-party state. It's communist. But they have had... probably, God, it'd be difficult to count them, but perhaps 10 changes of government, and I mean real changes within the Communist Party at the helm since 1975, whereas in Cambodia, Cambodia had the Khmer Rouge, and then there were the defectors from the western zone of the Khmer Rouge, and that's Hun Sen, and then they held power for another 30, 40 years. They're still pretty much running the show, although they've handed over their portfolios to their children.
Mm.
So it's not like, in terms of innovation and fresh ideas, and new people coming in.
Well, I think too, if you compare it, let's look at the Vietnamese Communist Party.
Right.
They do politics hard, mm-hmm. but it's internal. All right.
Yep.
That's where you do your politics in Vietnam. You do it within the party. We've seen the purges. We've seen very senior people ousted for various reasons, generally on the pretext at least of corruption. But of course that's a totally different dynamic in Cambodia, which one of the things which strikes me most still about Cambodia is that how it hasn't moved on politically. The system today is so reminiscent of the Sangam under Sihanouk.
In the 1960s.
The singular strong man who has the ability to hand out largesse to supporters who benefit from that, but there's never any real genuine loyalty. So let's have a look at what's happening now. So mm-hmm. Hun Sen's still there, he's in charge. They've intermarried, they've promoted the children of the various powerful political clans, but the trouble with this client-patron type of system is it's ultimately self-defeating. In that you empower your supporters, they become more powerful over time. They are ambitious by definition. And when the strongman goes, that leaves a huge vacuum. And indeed, I was speaking to a couple of old Cambodian friends who expressed a good deal of concern about the future of Cambodia on two particular fronts. The first being what happens when Hun Sen actually dies.
Mm-hmm.
Does this set off a sort of Game of Thrones competition for power?
At least a chain reaction.
Yeah. And the other one, of course, was the level of Chinese organised crime in the country.
It's been extraordinary what the Chinese have done in from the crime element. And
but, of course, this is enabled by the leadership of the country.
Right.
It doesn't happen in a vacuum. And they're taking a cut from it. And
And once they do crack down, well, guess what? Now it's running rampant in Myanmar, southern Laos.
Well, it moves around, of course.
But
I'm concerned about Cambodia. I don't I'm not very confident about the future. When that will happen is anybody's guess, but my gut feeling is that they're in for a difficult period politically.
Right, and a lot of that's also dictated by how much money they have in the bank, and there's not a lot there by all the accounts I'm hearing.
Well, all those buildings which are unfinished.
Yep.
I didn't get down to Sihanoukville, but I've read about it.
And I've been down there a few times, and it's... I mean, their own numbers initially were like 1,500. They've since toned that down to perhaps 500 skyscrapers, but depends on...
Well, the other thing, too, is that you've got this uber-rich group of elites, for want of a better word, and yet you've got increasing poverty in the countryside, ironically, through these microcredit programs, right? Which have been turned into a lucrative business model. So, yeah, I mean, I've learned over the years that it's inappropriate and ultimately futile to try to impose some sort of Western model on any non-Western country. And yet we go back to the comparison between Vietnam and Cambodia, and I can honestly say that I think there is a concern for the nation and the people through the party in Vietnam, which is not shared or replicated in Cambodia.
Right, and then while this was going on in Myanmar, we've still got the conflict, which the military simply can't claw back and win, although they've got Russian and Chinese support, which effectively is stopping Myanmar from falling into the abyss and becoming a failed state. But the war is continuing. The ethnic armed organisations, but they put up a hell of a fight and made extraordinary gains. And then, of course, there was the earthquake in Mandalay. And Mandalay has been a target for and ripe for takeover by the EAOs over the past 6 or 7 months. But where does the earthquake leave the military?
They've certainly shown themselves to be enduring,
right?
Through thick and thin.
Mm-hmm.
You may remember, I can't remember the exact details of the name of the storm, but
Nargis.
Nargis, yes. Well, the size of that catastrophe actually opened the country up.
It did. And it was a response by the government being so weak that it rallied the people together in terms of.
I think the earthquake showed the inadequacies of, of the administration in terms of its ability to respond. But of course, it's such a hugely complex equation in Myanmar. And we've had this conversation before. I mean,
which is where I'll be going next, by the way. Yeah.
But this is a 10-year story before anything sorted out. There's a singular lack of international engagement there. I think they are probably much more susceptible and aware of the multipolar world that we find ourselves in and become expert in playing off the parties. It's very important to China, of course, which again is in contrast to Vietnam, who just don't want to get involved with this with these growing tensions between between the United States and China. They just do not want to be involved in it. Extremely independent foreign policy.
I always think with the Vietnamese, when for all the criticisms of all the countries within ASEAN, what I like about the Vietnamese, where I have this enormous begrudging respect for them, is that you always know where you stand, which is can't be said for many of the other countries in ASEAN.
Yes, they're straight shooters.
Right, and the reason why I'm heading down this lane is, and Myanmar and Cambodia, we're in Thailand, which has got its own problems with the there's a deportation of the Uyghurs, which deeply upset the Americans, and Trump, as we both know, has seriously upset the apple cart. He's, you know, like a drunken rampage, just thrown it off the...
Well, he's certainly offended the Vietnamese.
Indeed. Yeah, the cancellation of the Agent Orange program, the cleanup, and the same with the
meanness of the lack of recognition, the low level diplomatic representation that the States. It just seemed to be mean-spirited.
And petty.
And counterproductive.
Oh, there was that order that went down that American diplomats were not to attend the 50th anniversary celebrations, which I just thought was petty and silly. But with that in mind, and we're sitting back here in Bangkok and we've watched what's happened in Australia with the kind of, I guess, repudiation of far right-wing policies, which I just thought was a vote by the sane, perhaps. But the last time we had this conversation for a podcast was we were in Hong Kong. And the main topic, which I thought was quite relevant back then, was this crisis of integrity, which you felt so strongly about. And
and particularly in the Western political world. I mean, we've seen what happened in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen what happened in the United States. And yes, it was very encouraging. The Australian election, albeit I'm Australian, I confess, but it was very encouraging because it was a victory for common sense and reason.
Right.
I mean, Australians don't like the radicals on either side. I mean, there are some issues. I found the result surprising in some respects. The lower house landslide to Labour surprised me a bit, because let's face it, both main political parties in the duopoly in Australia, they're still only pulling one third of the primary vote.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you win through the preferential system in the lower house. So I was surprised that Labour landslide was so large. I thought that the community-based independents would perform better than they did. But of course, we've got the Senate. So you may have a majority in the lower house, but it looks like Labour are going to be very dependent on, particularly the Greens, to make sure that their legislative program actually comes to pass.
And of course, the Greens were wiped out in the lower house.
They were in the lower house, but not in the upper house.
Hmm. You don't think the Greens are going to be forced to take a lesson from that?
Oh, look, I mean, that's speculative. They've proven to be as pragmatic as anybody else in Australian politics,
right.
As self-interested as any party. I think one of the main concerns in Australia is that most football clubs have more members than the main political parties, right? So you have a core of perhaps, let's say, anywhere between 40 to 60,000. I've looked at this and it's actually very hard to get hold of the figures, not least because you're looking at the LNP, which is actually three parties. The Liberal National Party Coalition is a coalition of three parties.
The Australian Conservatives.
Yeah. So you have a very small number of people undertaking these very important roles of pre-selection, for example, mm-hmm. setting policy. I think one of the key lessons was that the right side of Australian politics got it so terribly wrong. In terms of their increasingly hard line as the election campaign wore on. The temptation to embrace Trumpisms, just totally wrong, just totally misread the electorate and paid the price for it.
Okay, now, we all know what's happened under Trump too. We've witnessed what happened in Vietnam, and we've seen the differences in Cambodia and in countries like Myanmar, the rest of ASEAN and their allies, in particular Cambodia, which acts as a proxy for Chinese, they're all talking it up as if everything's normal. It's just a little skirmish and the military remains in control. Now, going back to what you were talking about 5 years ago in terms of the crisis of integrity, is there a growing realization that there is a crisis? I think there is, and I think Trump has forced the issue.
There is, and there's a perception which I think is justified, that the major parties in Australia are beholden to people other than the electorate.
Right, and which is obvious with, say, Gina Rinehart, depending on the Australian dollar, is potentially the richest woman in the world.
Sure. But look at the lack of guts, basically, in addressing issues like the gambling advertising issue.
Right.
It's easy. You just stop it, you know.
Yeah.
Because it's damaging. But, you know, these people are paying the piper, And the other thing, which is a particular bugbear of mine, is that I think Australia's sold itself short. We've sold our resources
mm-hmm.
very cheaply. The mining industry will come back with figures like, you know, the industry earns $200 billion worth of export income.
Right, let's make it a trillion.
Well, the point is that only a quarter of that actually goes to Australia and Australians.
Right.
In terms of royalties and jobs.
Yep.
The rest goes to largely overseas shareholders and the like. I mean, this gas issue, this offshore gas issue, is a complex, perhaps too complex to go into deeply in this forum.
We can do it later.
But we give it away. Why are we doing that? We should be getting a fair price for it and investing it into a proper sovereign wealth fund, because we don't have one.
Right, it's been talked about and discussed over the decades. In fact, there have been claims that we actually had one. But
we did, but that was there to the Australia Fund, I think it's called, just off the top of my head. It's there to actually fund the retirement benefits of the public service.
Right.
Well, not to invest in large infrastructure projects, not to improve the education system, not to improve the health system.
Or even to fund all of Australians.
Yeah. Well, and so I go back to the point where I got a distinct feeling through this trip that we in the West, and Australia in particular, which is my most recent experience, we're falling behind in this sort of development.
The gaps are narrowing.
Absolutely. Australia's economic complexity is on a par with some countries in Western Africa, for goodness sake.
Mm-hmm.
Industry's been hollowed out. We dig up rocks and we send them overseas.
Yep.
And the good Australians get to exercise their talents by leaving Australia and working elsewhere.
Yeah.
I should add, I'm back in Australia, so that doesn't count me.
A friend of mine who's is an Australian who... high-end intellectual, but he likes to quote the Japanese, who refer to America as their bank, the European as their fashion house, and the Australians as their quarry.
Well, indeed. Yeah. Well, they take a lot of the gas I was talking about and turn around and sell it back to us.
As with iron ore.
Yeah. So, yeah, look, there's some very crisis of integrity. I think the political system has become captured by the party machines in themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's fairly true to say that across the spectrum, most of our representatives are fairly uninspiring. There's certainly not the statesmanlike quality to any of them, with perhaps the exception of people like Penny Wong.
I think she does a pretty good job.
To name just one example. But they're not of the same caliber of the political leaders that we had in the 70s, 80s and 90s.
Right.
And into the 2000s, and I think the rot really started, post-Howard, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not getting the job done. And that's...
Okay, so Albanese has got a second term as Prime Minister. I think he was absolutely discouraged by the referendum and the way he put so much skin in the game. I backed it. I was all for it in terms of giving the Aboriginals a voice in Parliament. But he's got this new mandate. It's a thumping mandate. What should he do?
Well, certainly set some priorities.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be very interesting to see what those priorities are, because there's an awful lot of money to be spent on hip pocket promises that were made during the election campaign. One area that springs to mind is national defence.
Mm-hmm.
Our Navy, the Royal Australian Navy, a fine institution, very capable individuals who work within that organisation, and yet we have less than 10 surface combatant ships, which are now approaching 30 years old. Both our supply vessels are tied up alongside due to major mechanical issues. We have no mine counter-warfare capacity to speak of. And this whole submarine deal continues under AUKUS to look very, very shaky indeed.
More so now. Perhaps you've had a closer look, but I can't see anywhere where Trump has a position on AUKUS. or what it means anymore. I mean, I understood it before. I know a lot of people are opposed to it. I'm not. I think a lot of it's more political theatre than it is in terms of seriously delivering. But it's $360 billion.
Yeah. It's multi-levelled, of course. There's a lot more to it than just the submarine programme in terms of technology transfer. But I think the key question in that is, we have a long friendly history with the States. We're culturally very similar, but I don't think we can depend on them.
Well, I think history suggests that when you look at... No. We just came back from Vietnam. I get into a spot of bother with heated arguments sometimes because I don't believe the Americans lost the Vietnam War. I think they abandoned South Vietnam and that enabled the communists to come in 2 years later. I think we saw a repeat of that in Afghanistan in 21, and I think we were witnessing that, but kind of seems to have changed as of this week in terms of Trump's attitudes to Ukraine. And then I know there are several other examples where countries have witnessed American support and then bang, it's gone.
Hmm.
And, look, I mean, and they're sacrificed for political expediency at home.
Well, it's also not to say that there's a strong argument for interoperability between the two militaries, and there's a fine tradition for military collaboration, cooperation and trust, frankly. So that's a separate issue, but we also need to develop our own independent capacity, which of course is a great challenge. It's a large country. People don't realize how small the population is.
That's right, that's very true.
I have a friend who's a Texan, and he was absolutely gobsmacked when I said to him, well, you actually have more people in Texas than we have in the whole of Australia.
Yep.
Which presents all sorts of problems, of course, because you've got, you know, your roads are very long.
And it costs the same to build a four-lane highway from Melbourne to Perth as it does from San Francisco to New York.
Yeah.
It's,
so, there are those practical problems. So I get back to the point where I think the priorities of this this new administration in Australia is to get the shop running economically properly so we have an economic sovereignty, which leads to all sorts of other freedoms and lack of dependencies. I think we've disengaged from the region to a point which perplexes me. I'm thinking of that they've woken up in the Pacific, I think, but engagement with...
Better late than never.
With Asia. That's not to say that I have very, very strong person-to-person relationships here. Right. But somehow we still seem to be struggling with our position at the bottom of Asia.
Just before you came into the studio, I was reading that the Australian government has issued a travel warning for Australians about travelling to the United States and how difficult it is to get in there. And it's starting to read like, I think the warning that came out before that was Ecuador. So it kind of, it adds some clarity to where relations are between Australia and the United States. And then there's Five Eyes, of course, which I'm now referring to as Four Eyes. And there's, I had this belief that what's happening in America may be good for the rest of us in that, okay, we're going to have to stand up and defend for ourselves. Now, going back to this crisis of integrity, going back to what we witnessed in Vietnam, what is the potential for Australia to improve its relationship with Vietnam, which is, it seems to be steering away from multilateralism, and it's building bilateral relations with the Philippines. It's still got the Communist Brotherhood with Beijing, which I think annoys a lot of people. I was speaking to a few other people about this morning as well, and they're like, just wish they wouldn't. But
I think Australia does have good relationships, generally, diplomatically. But there's still a perception, I think, in this part of the world that Australia is America's deputy.
Mm-hmm. And which was a notion put forward by John Howard.
Well, indeed. And I think it was very true for many, many years. But to properly engage in the region and in the wider world, I think we have to shake that image. Now, that's not to say that we are necessarily unfriendly to the Americans, because they're a great bunch of people.
Right.
But I think we need to show as a nation some more guts in terms of being an independent player.
And now might be the time. I mean, again, quoting someone else, it was like quoting a congressman in the United States, if you think it's difficult being an enemy of America, try being their friend.
Well, it was particularly striking in Vietnam too. I think there's been a lot of goodwill extended towards the Americans. It's a long, complicated story. The MIA issue really opened it up. It was veteran to veteran who got drunk together, frankly, and built those personal relationships.
Good on them.
It's been a long period. I mean, that first 19 years or so was malicious. Although, again, there was a lot going on.
Early 1990s in Vietnam, but it was still very, very communist.
Well, indeed. And it had shown that it was quite prepared to cross a border and invade a country, rightly so, in that case. In fact, the response from the West to Vietnam's humanitarian action in Cambodia was disgraceful.
Right.
So it's been great to see that relationship develop over time. It wasn't until 94, if I understand, that relationships were normalised. 95 was at the first embassy. I reported on Clinton's visit.
Yeah.
And he was treated like a rock star.
Yeah.
And every subsequent president has engaged with Vietnam, with state visits. Trump, he was there for the North Korean summit, I think, in 2019.
And they're now sending troops to the Russians.
Yeah, but he's probably, in his first term, I wouldn't personally describe that as a state visit, because it was it was an event held in Hanoi. So I'm at a loss at why there would be this lack of generosity, particularly...
Which comes back to, what do the rest of us do regards where we're going next in this kind of Trump, I was going to say Trump-led world, but that's not the right way of putting it.
No.
It's going to be an absence of the Americans, which means the rest of the planet is going to have to decide not whose side they're on, but how are they going to structure their trade negotiations.
They have to adapt to a multipolar world.
Right, and probably based on bilateral relations, which makes it all the more difficult.
Yeah. Well, yes and no, I suppose. I mean, we are drifting into the realm of speculation here, of course.
Which is okay.
Yeah, we're quite good at that. We've got lots of opinions. Sovereignty. I think we have to become more conscious of our own sovereignty. We have good relationships with the United States. It's a 100-year history, but that doesn't mean that we should ignore all those other potentially, lucrative, if not, not the correct word, those other relationships which are in our own best interests to encourage.
And pursue, and that will include Southeast Asia.
Indeed.
Hugh Watkin. As always, it's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Luke, always a good time to talk with you.
All right. Thanks.